Blog Talk Radio.
And good afternoon from Fairfax, Virginia, where the sun, after a soggy, wet week, has finally come out. This is your host, John Gresham, and you are listening to Military Monday, the weekly show on the Rightstream Radio Network of Blog Talk Radio, which is devoted specifically to matters military. Today we're going to talk a little about history. Not that far back, actually, just about 10 years. For those of you who have either forgotten or tried to forget it, our invasion of Iraq took place 10 years ago this year. And while there have been many, many fine books and documentaries and other programs and even feature films that have been devoted to Iraq, the one thing that has not been talked much about is the influence of air power in that conflict, particularly during the early stages of the invasion in March and April of 2003. This is in stark contrast to just a dozen years earlier in 1991, when as soon as the war was over, the U.S. Air Force undertook a huge multi-million dollar, multi-volume study of the air war called the Gulf War Air Power Survey, or as we call it in the business, GWAPS, which resulted in a five-volume, massive document that still remains the benchmark behind studies of air campaigns. Sadly, though, there hasn't been a similar type of effort for Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003, possibly because it's not as popular or wasn't seen as big a win. But that doesn't mean there aren't important things to be learned from it and important lessons that we should be taking into our next set of conflicts wherever and whenever they may be. Thankfully, though, there is Mr. Benjamin S. Lambeth, a longtime air power enthusiast, researcher, historian, and writer who has been involved in multiple studies of past air wars, starting back during the Cold War with studies of the Russian Air Force and its tactics and what they would have done had World War III ever happened, along with extensive writing about air operations in the Persian Gulf, in the Balkans, in Afghanistan, and now he has produced a single-volume history of the air war in 2003 in Operation Iraqi Freedom called The Unseen War, published by the fine folks at the U.S. Naval Institute Press in Annapolis, Maryland. It goes and provides an important book for those of us who are trying to keep some perspective on how that war developed, what contributions air power made to it, and what we maybe need to do in the future. So without further ado, I'm going to go and introduce you all to Mr. Benjamin S. Lambeth. Ben, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. I hear you loud and clear.
Now, Ben, you have been involved with studying air power for a long time, and let's just start with the fact that you were working during the Cold War, mostly for the RAND Corporation out in Santa Monica.
That's correct.
And your studies ranged from visiting bases all over the world. You even got a couple of hundred hours in high-performance tactical aircraft, did you not?
I did indeed. As a matter of fact, I've been privileged over the last 30-plus years to have accumulated some 400 hours in about 40 different jet aircraft types worldwide, with all the U.S. services and about eight foreign air forces as well.
And I'm not one to have a lot of envy, but boy, sir, I envy you all those hours. I'm guessing you've had to mend your flight suit a few times and probably polish a few dings out of your helmet.
A time or two. I really ought to stress on that point that as fun as it's been, most important, it's been a tremendous learning experience. I mean, only up to a point can one sit in the library stacks and read books about these things. It's really indispensable to have the opportunity to be out actually in the operational arena, to talk with the operators, to brief and debrief with them, and to fly with them. I have been blessed with having have the opportunity to do just about everything in a high-performance jet except actually being shot at. I mean, the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps have almost put me through military pilot training under the table. And it has been a tremendous, I think, contributor to whatever credibility I have in explaining what they do to the literate masses.
Now, you make an important point that you've been out with them. And you haven't just been out with them. You've been out with them for a generation. In other words, the people who are running today's Air Force were little itty-bitty-baby lieutenants when you first met them.
That's true. I got my first exposure to this world ever back in January of 1976 when I was privileged to fly my first T-38 aggressor sortie at Nellis Air Force Base, Nevada, in the second ever Red Flag large force training exercise, which was really the cutting edge, the very first effort that the Air Force and alongside the Air Force, the Navy, the Marine Corps had begun to make to recover from the brutal lessons of Vietnam and to really develop a new combat repertoire for the here and now to deal with the Soviet Union now and downstream. I mean, that was a time when I well remember at the weapons school right across the street from the aggressor squadrons, Captain Ron Keyes, Captain John Jumper, and Captain Dick Myers were instructors in the F-4 at the weapons school. All of them went on later to have a major role in shaping the evolution of American air power, and all retired as four-star generals. So I've really been able to watch that community as it's grown over the last generation.
And we'll come back to talking about a few more of the young lieutenants and folks that you later saw grow into Air Force leaders. But let's talk a little bit about this book. Obviously, you've been involved in a number of studies on air power, air campaigns, and air operations going back to when you and I were much younger men. Why this one? What was it that drove you, one, to do this book, and secondly, to go to, of all places, the U.S. Naval Institute Press?
Well, I should first mention that the book was a U.S. government-sponsored study conducted by the RAND Corporation, where I was during the duration of my research and writing of it. And it was a natural consequence of work I'd done earlier. It was sponsored by U.S. Central Command Air Forces, the organization that actually conducted the air war. Maybe best to run the clock back a bit. You mentioned some earlier work I'd done on Soviet air power, the Soviet Air Force, and how Soviet air power might fit into a larger theater war in Europe. I did a book that the Smithsonian Institution Press published in 1999 titled Russia's Air Power in Crisis, which really summarized 20 years of work at RAND on Soviet air power, looking not just at the aircraft and the equipment, but also the pilot, the command and control system, the training tactics and procedures that all came together to make the Soviet Air Force the kind of fighting machine it was. Then along came Desert Storm, and then the air wars of the 1990s, Operation Deliberate Force in the Balkans in 1995, and then followed by the NATO's air war for Kosovo in 1999. All of those were opportunities to look at different types of air power in action. They led me to write what I still think is my seminal contribution, a book that was published in 2000 by Cornell University Press called The Transformation of American Air Power. And from that, after 9/11, it seemed only natural to reach out and try and tell the story of the Afghan air war as it was being formed. I had the good fortune of, by that time, knowing all of the principals in the Air Force who would be responsible for making that war happen. And I, almost the day after the first bomb landed in October of 2001 in Afghanistan, got in touch with Lieutenant General Chuck Wald, who at the time was the Air Component Commander for CENTCOM, and asked him point blank if he would sponsor a major GWAPS-type study that I could do on that. He cleared me hot within the space of a couple of years. I produced a substantial RAND book under CENTAF sponsorship called Air Power Against Terror. And all the while I was researching that book, of course, CENTCOM and CENTAF were getting geared up for the Iraq War. And by that time, it was only natural to segue into a follow-on study, again, that would be sponsored by the government, by CENTAF. General Buzz Mosley was now the Air Component Commander. I called him up point blank and said, "Buzz, this is about to happen. can you support a follow-on? And he said approved right on the spot. So one thing led to the next, and it just was a natural consequence of the much work I'd done in the past. It was a kind of a continuing movable feast as it grew, as the study grew over the years. It was only published this year, 10 years later, but that 10-year block of time gave me ample time to pull together material, interview virtually all the principal players, and to write what I hope is about as definitive as one can get, an account of the air war at the unclassified level. Why I went to the Naval Institute Press, that kind of made sense. The Naval Institute Press, back in 1995, published the unclassified summary volume of the Gulf War Air Power Survey commissioned by the Air Force that was done by Elliot Cohen and Tom Keeney at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. They later, in 2006, I believe, published the Army's account of V-Corps' operations in the Iraq War by Colonel Greg Fontenot and two of his co-authors. And so it made for a natural fit. Admiral Vern Clark was a good friend of mine, former Chief of Naval Operations. He was the CNO during the Iraq War, and I went to him and asked if he would open some doors for me at the Naval Institute Press. One thing led to the next, and they were happy to take it aboard. So the book is just released. The formal release date is tomorrow, October 15th, and I hope it makes a substantial contribution toward the education of the next generation of American airmen.
Well, a first look at it certainly indicates it reminds me a great deal of a Christmas fruitcake. It's just jam-packed full of stuff. Let's talk a little bit about some of those things, starting with, okay, so you're going to throw an invasion of one of the larger Middle Eastern countries, one which you've had with a dozen years earlier. What was the situation in early 2003 as we got ready to invade, and what kind of forces, air forces, did we have lined up to support this?
We were ready to go because we had just fought the war in Afghanistan the year before. General Mosley referred to the Afghan war as what he called the JV scrimmage for Operation Iraqi Freedom to follow, and so the forces were peaked. It was basically the same players. You had the same president, the same Secretary of State, the same Secretary of Defense, the same air and ground component commanders. General Tommy Franks was the Joint Task Force commander. So all the pieces were in place for the lessons that were learned in the Afghan campaign to be rolled forward, developed and modified as appropriate for Iraq. But before we get into this, I'd like to roll the clock back a bit and at least mention for your audience two things about that war that we need to constantly bear in mind. First of all, is the danger that it will be forgotten. You remember it was 10 years ago, what was called the three-week major combat phase of Operation Iraqi Freedom that brought the statue down and that toppled Saddam's regime. That was 10 years ago, and it was followed by six or more years of really slow motion, bleeding, counterinsurgency warfare of attrition on the ground, during which time more than 4,000 American soldiers and airmen were killed in action in a way that was so captivating that the truly brilliant three-week major combat phase that brought the regime down in the first place is in danger of being forgotten, and it should not be, because it was a spectacular, I would say even an exemplary, exercise in joint and combined force employment. The second point that needs to be borne in mind, and it has to do with the title that I chose for the book, The Unseen War, was that it really was. It was, to most folks who observed the unfolding of the three-week major combat phase of OIF only through the lenses of Fox News or CNN, they would have come away, understandably, with the impression that the war was fought and won largely by ground forces and tanks with M-16s and other appurtenances of land warfare. The air war, by contrast, was kind of out of the picture, and there are two reasons for that. First of all, if you remember back at the time of Desert Storm 12 years ago, the first 38 days of that campaign were air only. So every night you had TV watchers looking at television images of cockpit video film showing laser-guided bombs homing unerringly into air shafts of hardened bunkers. And it was only in the last 4 days that the combined air-land operation consolidated the effects of the air campaign and completed the eviction of occupying Iraqi forces from Kuwait. So to that extent, ODS, Operation Desert Storm, is still remembered by many as an air war. In this case, the ground war dominated, and a big part of that was had to do with the fact that this time, for the first time really in American military experience, General Franks approved the embedding of some 500 reporters with CENTCOM troops going to war. Most of those, the vast majority, all but about 5%, were with Allied ground troops. The reason for that, really a twofold reason. One, you couldn't very realistically fly reporters in the backseat of strike aircraft because a crew member had to be there. But more important, the host nations, particularly Saudi Arabia, would not allow a civilian presence in the air operations center. And so you really didn't have the on-scene reporting of ongoing air operations anywhere like we had in the case of the ground war. So you didn't have images of air operations competing with the images of soldiers with reporters in Kevlar helmets racing to Baghdad. And yet, the air war was absolutely pivotal in enabling that rush to Baghdad and toppling of the regime in just 3 weeks, and we can talk about that to whatever extent you like.
Let's start with a basic metaphor for the campaign plan. Obviously, Tommy Franks, as the Joint Task Force or JTF commander, was juggling a lot of balls. I mean, just the number of components: air, naval, ground, marine, special operations, allied. I mean, and of course, logistics, transport. Being a modern JTF commander, even on a small level, is a massive intellectual exercise.
And so, by the way, all of those components you mentioned were pivotal.
But the Air One has a special place, not just because you and I are air enthusiasts, but the simple fact is it is their job traditionally in American warfare, certainly since the Second World War, to allow ground forces to advance to their targets without danger of air and or missile attack. In other words, their job is to literally put a bubble over the top of those troops, make sure that the enemy's air power and space power does not affect them, and then conversely, that our air space power dominates the battlefield, correct?
I think that's a fair way to put it. I might explain it a little bit differently. The expression I've used typically when I lecture to war college audiences is to say that that modern air power, as it has evolved since Vietnam, American air power, as it has evolved since Vietnam, has now become the great enabler. It makes work for all the other force elements much less painful than it was in the past, because it allows them basically access to their goals, if properly used, without having to go head-to-head against enemy forces and incur large numbers of casualties. To sum it up in a nutshell, it provides both freedom from attack and freedom to attack for the land forces and all the other force elements. So to that extent, it is an indispensable enabler. Iraqi freedom, it was not an air war. Air power didn't win the war. But without it, the outcome would have been dramatically different and vastly more painful. Again, it should be best viewed as an indispensable enabler that dramatically increases the efficiency of joint combined force operations. So, yeah, I think you hit the nail pretty much on the head.
And this air power and space power, and I include space because space was a huge enabler, as you point out, for the entire effort. This thing was global. You had people fighting as far away as Cheyenne Mountain, watching ballistic and cruise missile launches. You had ships out in the Persian Gulf and the Red Sea launching cruise missiles and providing air cover with their Aegis systems. You even had Army Patriot units which are not exactly the most mobile assets, dragging their resources north to keep that air defense and anti-missile bubble over the top of 5th Corps and 1st MEF. I mean, and this, and notice, I haven't even mentioned airplanes yet when I talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking about a diverse set of resources that the air commander there had.
I mean, if you just look at an array of the hardware that was committed to this operation, I can't quote you the precise numbers, but there were about, if you include Navy, Marine Corps, along with the Air Force and the British and Australian contributions, there were a total of some 730, 740 fighter aircraft, another 225 or so tankers, which were absolutely essential. I mean, 51 heavy bombers of all three types that we have, the B-52, the B-1, and the B-2, for a total of about 1,800 combat support aircraft altogether, dedicated to General Tommy Franks as the Joint Task Force Commander. I mean, that was truly an air armada by any measure.
And this was not the easiest theater. It was a very different arena than 1991 because we did not have all of the coalition partners that we had in 91, which imposed vast limits on
and
ramps.
And we didn't have the bases that made a big difference. Just to take the tanker example, during Desert Storm, we were able to concentrate some 300, I believe, tankers on just five bases. Whereas in the case of Iraqi Freedom, we had fewer available tankers, and they had to be separated among 17 different bases because of basing restrictions in the area. Turkey, particularly, because it had felt itself burned from having supported Allied forces during Desert Storm, they lost $100 billion on trade from their Arab neighbors as a result of that. And so at the last minute, the Turkish parliament said no. Prime Minister Erdogan went to bat, but the Turkish parliament at the end said no, it would not allow Turkish soil to be used as a launch point either for strike operations or tanker support. And that took away instantly some 400, two wings worth of 400 aircraft, 400 fighter aircraft, maybe half that number of tankers, and forced lots of workarounds to the point where we had tankers operating in the war zone coming from as far away as Bulgaria. That was something very different from the Desert Storm experience. And it was General Mosley really, in his after-action briefings on the experience, called tankers. The tankers were the long pole in the tent. That was the one failure point that could have caused it all to come unglued if we had not been able to provide the tanker support, which we did in the end, and it was really a heroic effort.
Let's talk real quick. You mentioned General Mike Mosley, known affectionately to many as Moose. Talk a little bit about...
No, he's known as Buzz.
Buzz, okay.
He goes by Buzz. That's been his almost his born name.
Okay, well, sorry about that. Different communities apparently address him differently, but let's talk a little bit about General Mosley. Who was he? What was he at the time? And what was his experience base?
Well, he's a fighter pilot to the heart. All of his operational experience has been in the F-15, the F-15 A and C, the air superiority version of that aircraft. He's a graduate from Texas A&M. He's an Aggie. Got his commission through the Air Force ROTC program there, a career Air Force officer ever since. At one point, when he was Lieutenant Colonel, he commanded the F-15 division at the Air Force Fighter Weapons School at Nellis Air Force Base. He later returned as a Brigadier General to command the 57th Wing, which is really the home of the fighter pilot at Nellis, the wing that includes the Air Force's aggressor squadrons, the weapons school, and that conducts Red Flag, a bimonthly large force training exercise that I mentioned earlier that involves both the Air Force, Navy, and Marine Corps and invited Allied participation. He went on from there. He served a brief tour as the Director of Legislative Liaison on the Air Staff and finally was tapped to become the Air Component Commander for U.S. Central Command at just the time, right at the time that 9/11 occurred. So he was a pivotal figure. He was placed at just the right time to bring his talent to bear in commanding two spectacular exercises in air employment, being Operation Enduring Freedom in 2001 through about March of 2002, and then segueing quickly thereafter into Operation Iraqi Freedom in March and April of 2003.
Who were some of the other important people that were involved that our listeners might want to know about during this time?
Well, Vice Admiral at the time, Tim Keating, a Navy attack pilot, was the Maritime Component Commander, and he was responsible for Fifth Fleet and all the naval contribution to the joint and combined war. Buzz had at his side two world-class airmen from the United Kingdom and Australia, and at the time, Air Vice Marshal Glenn Torpy, who was the British Air Contingent Commander for Operation Iraqi Freedom, and at the time, Group Captain Jeff Brown, an F-18 pilot from the Australian Air Force, who was the Australian Air Contingent. Interestingly enough, as a measure of their talent, both of those two officers went on to command their respective air forces, with Air Chief Marshal Glenn Torpy heading the RAF, and Air Marshal Jeff Brown continues to this day to be the Chief of the Australian Air Force. Two very fine, talented officers.
And it's also worth noting that the Army, the Marine Corps, and Special Operations made important contributions to this air power stew that was going to go into Iraq, correct?
That's correct. At the time, Major General Jim Amos was the commander of the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing, responsible for all of the land-based Marine Corps aircraft in the AOR. Interestingly enough, shortly before the campaign kicked off, General Mosley had a huddle with General Amos and General Conway and other of the Marine Corps principals discussing the game plan to come, ironing out some differences in operational practices between the Air Force and the Marine Corps to a point where Buzz Mosley was able to work out an implicit trust relationship with the Marine Corps that allowed the Marines, in effect, to kind of fight their own private war in their area of responsibility with the confidence that whenever General Mosley needed their aircraft, he could call on them, in return for which General Mosley guaranteed the Marine Corps, if they needed additional air component air, it would be there. It was an absolutely seamless performance, and I would suggest a role model for cross-service interaction in the most efficient way. I mean, the Air Force Marine Corps relationship and OIF was a model of how it should be done.
I get the feeling that something similar was probably done with the special operations community, because I have never, with one exception of a blue-on-blue bombing up in the north, there was virtually no problems whatsoever with the relations with the Central Command Air Forces and the special ops community. In fact, they really worked quite well together.
That's correct. I'm much less comfortable talking about that because so much of the soft operations were compartmented. Just less of their story has been told. But one can say for sure that particularly with regard to the Western Desert in Iraq, the air component had an almost seamless relationship with the soft operators on the ground. That really was an air soft operation from start to finish. As you may remember, the big concern was the possibility of a repeat of what had happened during Desert Storm, when the Iraqis fired a number of Scud missiles into Israel to the point that the Israelis about entered the war. The United States government and CENTCOM were deeply concerned to prevent anything that might draw the Israelis into this war. to the extent that we had an Air Force two-star general and a colonel as his assistant, both fighter pilots, in Tel Aviv briefing the Israeli military leadership on a daily basis as to how the war was going. And explaining in intimate operational detail what we were doing in the air and on the ground to prevent a repeat of the Scud attacks that had happened in 1991. And looking back with 2020 hindsight, there were no Scuds fired at all. So that mission, to the extent that there were Scuds there to begin with, succeeded flawlessly.
And for our listeners who might want to ask some questions or just make a comment, please feel free to call in. Our call-in line is area code 347-945-7246. Again, area code 347-945-7246. Let's
talk. It might also be worth adding here that experience with Allied air power and the special operations community in the Western Desert brought about a synergy that we've never seen before, where the soft forces developed almost a symbiotic relationship with their air supporters and vice versa, to the point now where airmen will proudly say that soft gets it when it comes to understanding air power in a way that's unique throughout the land warfare community. I mean, that really was a crucible in which almost a new form of a new fusion of air-land capability was forged.
Certainly the combat controller community down at Hurlburt and other places has really been responsible for a lot of that, and it's been promulgated out to all of the various special operations service components. Let's talk a little bit now about the time just before and just at the beginning of Operation Iraqi Freedom. There'd been the development in the previous 12 years of a truly important revolutionary munition, and these were ones guided by GPS. The most notable that most people is something called JDAM, or the Joint Direct Attack Munition, which is a lot like a laser-guided bomb, except that instead of screwing a laser guidance kit onto a conventional 500, 1,000-pound, or 2,000-pound bomb, you strap on a GPS package, and it'll go through. It'll go through whatever weather is between you and the ground. It just doesn't care because it's getting its guidance.
That's the important distinction. I mean, the one difference between a laser-guided bomb and a JDAM is the JDAM does not have to see the target. It doesn't home on an object. It homes on coordinates. And if the coordinates are correct, it will hit the target.
And yet we used every kind of precision munition imaginable from 1960s era 500-pound laser-guided bombs to the latest and greatest JDAMs.
Well, but the big difference was we had them in abundance by 2003. If you look back at the Desert Storm experience in 91, a lot was made of the use of precision weapons by the F-117, by the F-15E, by some F-16s, other combat aircraft, but only about 8% of the munitions dropped throughout the 6 weeks of Desert Storm were precision-guided. When you fast-forward to 2003 and Operation Iraqi Freedom, during the first couple of nights of the campaign, every weapon that was dropped was a precision weapon. Collateral damage concerns have become paramount. It was essential to honor those collateral damage constraints. Every weapon dropped honored collateral damage restrictions and was a precision munition. It made a fundamental difference in the efficiency of the air operation.
In addition, there was another almost revolutionary development, which we'd seen beginning in the Kosovo War and the previous 2 years in Afghanistan, which was big bombers were back, and they had been equipped with precision weapons, and they could carry them in abundance.
They also carried targeting pods that had been developed for fighters. You had the B-52 carrying a sniper pod. And what's interesting about this is that it erases the distinction between strategic and tactical aircraft. I often, when I lecture on this, I'll make the point, Ben's first law, of understanding air power is thou shalt never use the adjective strategic to describe things. I mean, there are strategic goals, there are strategic effects that are outcome determining. But, you know, why call the B-52 a strategic bomber when it was doing quintessentially tactical close air support during Operation Iraqi Freedom? And for that matter, why call the F-111 a tactical aircraft when it conducted quintessentially strategic operations in the opening moments of Desert Storm in 1991? Those distinctions have been blurred today.
Now, we really didn't start Iraqi Freedom on the evening of March 19th.
In fact,
we had been for 12 years conducting air operations over northern and southern Iraq as part of the no-fly, and really the suppression of enemy air defenses, command and control, and such had begun some months before the March 19th start date, correct?
That's correct, and it made things much easier for General Franks when the time came to press for G-Day, the actual formal start of the ground, and A-Day, the start of the formal air operation. It's commonly said by most that whereas Desert Storm was a 38-day air-only campaign until the last 4 days of ground operations, Iraqi Freedom saw the air and ground push take place more or less concurrently. That is not strictly speaking true. I mean, we had, as you mentioned, over the course of 12 years after Desert Storm, conducted a slow-motion air campaign against the Iraqi air defense system on the installment plan, taking it down piece by piece, such that, and even during the less than a year before the beginning of Iraqi Freedom in March of 2003, at General Franks' direction, General Mosley instituted a much stepped-up version of Operation Southern Watch, which he called Southern Focus, which was intended expressly to respond to any Iraqi act of hostility against Allied aircraft, not just against the offending weapon, but against any air defense-related target of choice throughout the southern no-fly zone area in Iraq, such that really by the time it came to launch the ground offensive on March the 20th of 2003, dominance, if not air dominance, certainly a comfortable degree of air superiority had already been established, such that the air component did not have to divert sorties against defense suppression targets, and it could roll directly in and support the Army on the ground. You can thank 10-plus years of Southern Watch and those very, very intense months of Operation Southern Focus for providing that capability. So it really is true that that much of the air work had already been done when the war formally started.
Okay, and let's talk about when the war officially started. And really, in a lot of ways, it began almost simultaneously on the evening of March 19th as Air Force Special Operations units began to fly Special Forces A-teams to go after critical infrastructure targets into southern Iraq, and at the same time...
And the Western Desert. That was very important as well.
Right. And at the same time, we got an intelligence report that there was a chance to take a shot at Saddam and his kids, and so we dispatched a pair of F-117s to do that job. Talk a little bit about those early operations on the evening of March 19th and 20th.
Well, that turn of events really very nicely bore out the proposition that every plan is a basis for change. CENTCOM and CENTAF had gone through more than a year of really, really rigorous fine-tuning of a choreographed joint air-land campaign concept with a lot of tugging and hauling back and forth over who goes first and who goes when. When along came that report out of the clear blue sky on the 19th of March, where there was what was thought to be reliable intel reporting that Saddam Hussein and his two sons were closeted in a place in the Baghdad suburbs called Dora Farms, and that presented the prospective opportunity of a decapitation strike that might obviate the need to fight the war altogether. And so a lot of last-minute rejiggering was done with the operations plan. General Franks asked if the air component could provide the needed cruise missiles, which was the selected weapon of choice at the time. It later was reported that, well, there are indications of a hardened bunker at Dorf Arms in which Saddam and his two sons would be protected, meaning that the cruise missiles would not have the penetration capability to achieve the desired objective. So then the question became, can we get an F-117 loaded with the proper weapon that used the EGBU-27 hard target munition? There was only one aircraft properly configured. The 8th Fighter Squadron, which operated the aircraft, was able quickly to configure a second one and finally got a green light to go just minutes before the time window closed. The two F-117s got airborne. They got to the target. The target was obscured by weather. The pilots had to actually see the target in order to drop. There was a clearing just long enough for them to visually identify the target. Both the bombs were dropped from each aircraft. They all hit exactly where they were intended to go. The F-117s got out cleanly just before sunrise, and only later did it turn out that it was based on false intelligence that Saddam and his sons were not there after all. But it really did demonstrate the flexibility of air power to be able to swing from one expected game plan to something fundamentally different in a space of just minutes, literally.
And for those who later were critical of having tried and supposedly missed, I can't help but remember a conversation in the down at the Air University with Colonel John Warden in 1995.
I know him well.
Oh, yeah. We both know him well. And at that moment, he made his point to me that if where Iraq was concerned, there was one direct mean point of impact that would change the world with as little as a 500-pound bomb, and that was the head of Saddam Hussein. So, if
and that, by the way, that by the way bears out my point earlier about the danger of misusing the term strategic. Something strategic is something that has outcome-determining effects. It has nothing to do with the weapon itself. I mean, I would put it to you that a K-bar knife in the hand of a Navy SEAL at the throat of Saddam Hussein at the right time would have been, to all intents and purposes, a strategic weapon simply because of the strategic effect that it would have produced. So we really need to get out of our heads this idea that strategic equals big or strategic equals nuclear. Strategic has to do with the effects that you're seeking. And any force employment that is able to produce outcome-determining results, I would say is by definition strategic. One other point, John, I think we ought to get to before the time runs out, and that is to remember that, and as the Iraqi Freedom Experience drove home to us, in regime change wars, it's not over until it's over. And this is a point that if there's any one lesson that we need to take away from the OIF experience, it is that if you're in the business of regime change, remember, Desert Storm was just a coercive operation to get Iraqi forces out of Kuwait. By the same token, Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan, it was just intended to drive the Taliban and Al-Qaeda out. In the Balkans, deliberate force and allied force were just intended to force the Balkan, the Bosnian Serbs to cease and desist from harassing civilians. OIF, Iraqi Freedom, was fundamentally different. That was an intentional regime change operation, which meant not just bringing down the regime, but putting something in place that would function effectively. And whereas the coalition performed brilliantly at what was called Phase 3, i.e. the regime toppling, we were grossly unprepared for what followed, and that left us with six very, very difficult and costly years of counterinsurgency before things finally stabilized to some degree in Iraq. I think the history of the Iraq War is still not over yet. The outcome is yet to be determined. But if there's any one big picture lesson that emerges from the OIF experience, it is that if you're in the business of regime change operations, phase four, the stabilization and consolidation phase, is even more important than the major combat phase. And we did not do a good job of seeing to that.
Many stories to be talked about there, and probably more than a few books about war termination to be written as well.
Well, there is a very rich literature on that. In fact, most of the books that have been written on Iraq since 2003 have had to do with the difficulties that we inherited by not having properly insured against the downside consequences of regime change.
Let's talk a little about air power mythology during Operation Iraqi Freedom, particularly the mythology being pushed by the media. You and I earlier discussed the fact that the media really did not understand the campaign plan as it was being executed, nor did they have any real sense of air power's real contribution. Let's talk about the two great myths that they were promulgating at that time, the whole idea of shock and awe, as if that was going to make Saddam Hussein and his kids put their hands up and wet their pants, and the idea that you could go ahead and selectively kill the top leadership, or the so-called deck of cards, just through a series of precision targeted strikes. I'm going to give this to you. Have at, sir.
Well, CENTCOM never bought into that. It's important to bear in mind that shock and awe, it's a term that came from the title of a pamphlet that had been promulgated recently that had come to the attention of Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, arguing for force employment to achieve rapid dominance. And somehow that term, just because of its flashiness, caught on with the media. General Moseley and his CAOC staff never used it, or ever saw it as a proper characterization of what the air campaign was all about. It was the idea that a lot of fireballs going off at the same time would generate such paralysis that the regime would come to a grinding halt. That was something that CENTAF strove for, but never had any great expectation that it would make the difference. I mean, there's an argument by some that, well, we tried decapitation, we tried shock and awe, and it didn't work, so we had to revert to the plain old-fashioned going after enemy ground forces that ultimately brought about the regime change. That's really not the way it was ever planned. The intent was to start from the inside and work out, and the air campaign from day one onward was expected to focus mainly, if not exclusively, on Iraqi fielded forces. Keep their aircraft from flying. Every runway was cratered in the first hour of the war, and to keep Iraq's substantial ground forces from never coming head-to-head with the invading coalition ground forces. Interestingly enough, if you look with 2020 hindsight at the allocation of sorties, only a small percentage were devoted against leadership targets. I think more than 15,000 strike sorties altogether over that three-week period, well over three-quarters of the total, were devoted exclusively to General Moseley's support to the counter-land war. And so, I mean, really, shock and awe was a term that was a flash in the pan with the media, but never caught on with the actual players. It was never used by CENTAF.
And while we did take a couple of shots at Saddam and his rather malignant offspring, we really didn't kill that many of the top 52 leaders that were in the so-called deck of cards during the so-called major combat phase of Iraqi Freedom, did we?
Well, they were very elusive targets. They knew the war was coming. There was a hope for a time to get them at their desks at 9 o'clock in the morning, but because of the kind of slow motion war that the war came on. By and by, the Air Operations Center made a determination that most of those targets have probably already left where they are. So many of the originally planned air targets were taken off the air tasking order altogether as the land component was moving to Baghdad much more quickly than was originally anticipated. And, of course, I think we can see with hindsight that we paid some downside costs for this, and that a lot of those leaders at the operation level, particularly in the Republican Guard, who stayed on were very likely pivotal players in the insurgency that we had to deal with for 6 years thereafter. So there was a downside cost for that.
There's a popular saying within military circles that no campaign plan survives first contact with the enemy. And obviously, Iraqi freedom ran into its own unique problems almost from the moment that we hit the start line, ranging from the disjointed, hiccup having gone for the Dora Farm strike to the emergence just a few days into the campaign of that massive sandstorm that just basically froze everybody in place for 3 days.
Well, it froze the ground component. It froze the ground component, but not the air component. The air war never slacked in its intensity. Even though there was a brief pause, which General McKiernan, the ground component commander, called to take advantage of the sandstorm to reconstitute and attend to some logistics needs, the air war continued, and you had Global Hawk unmanned surveillance platforms at 65,000 feet, the Joint Stars with its synthetic aperture radar and moving target indicator radar was able to look at a core size field through the sandstorm and drop JDAMs with unerring accuracy against concentrated Iraqi troops who thought that because they couldn't see us, we couldn't see them. It really did demonstrate the sandstorm, as much of a curveball as it was. The weather forecasting was good enough that we saw it coming well enough in advance that the Air Operations Center was able to swing the loading of munitions away from laser guided bombs, which would have worked very poorly in the sandstorm, to almost entirely JDAM loadouts, which were totally unaffected by the sandstorm. So the air war went on really without missing a beat for 3 days. And it has really proven that we now have a 24-hour all-weather capability that we never had before, and it has taken both night and weather sanctuaries away from the enemy.
Now, in terms of adaptability and flexibility, particularly from folks from my point of view, because I write a lot about special operations, nothing that the Air Force did was so much showing its adaptability and flexibility as the move to supporting the PKK insurgency led by Colonel Charlie Cleveland up in northern Iraq. 16 Iraqi divisions standing up along the Green Line could have potentially slaughtered the Kurds up there, and instead the Air Force made it possible for Charlie, with just one special forces group and stuff being flown in, to take the offensive and meet the 101st when they were coming out of Baghdad. This was obviously something that was done on the fly, but very impressive.
Well, it was not done entirely on the fly. I remember that a little-known piece of the getting ready for Iraqi freedom had to do with some very carefully rehearsed field training exercises between the air component and the soft forces in the Nellis Air Force Base Range Complex out in the Nevada desert before the campaign kicked off, such that when it came time to execute, they had done it before. I mean, there was not a whole lot of real-time improvising going on. They had a fairly well-rehearsed game plan in hand by that time. And it really does bear in mind another axiom of military operations, that you fight like you train. If you train well,
agreed.
You will fight well.
And let's face it, who likes to train more than our friends in the special ops community? They're all about the training. It came down just a matter of weeks after the start to an end game. And for most people, they saw that as the tearing down of Saddam's statue. But how did the Air Forces of Central Command end the major combat phase? How did they come to see the end of the major combat phase there?
Well, I think just by continuing to do what the day-to-day air tasking order had mandated, beating down the Republican Guard and other Iraqi forces to the point where the land component could enter downtown Baghdad and occupy the capital virtually painlessly. I mean, there were literally no major tank-on-tank skirmishes during this war, maybe one or two minor shootouts with a T-62 here and there. But the principal ground commanders were the first to report that that the air component had made things that much easier. There was one of my most memorable quotations from the entire campaign experience was a quote from General Mosley on the 5th of April. It was right toward the last week of the campaign when he gave his first interview to the media. And he said sort of wryly, you know, I find it interesting when people say we're softening them up. We're not softening them up. We're killing them. Allied air power, precision, high-altitude bombing against concentrated Iraqi ground troops on the ground through the weather when necessary, independently of ground action, did most of the heavy lifting that made the three-week invasion and regime collapse possible. So basically, the air component continued to do its thing right up until the end game, and there it was. And to this day, until we finally withdrew from Iraq, the air component continued to play. It was a very different role, much less kinetic, more by way of just on-call providing close air support for coalition ground troops who now found themselves in a slow-motion counterinsurgency war. Air power took a backseat to ground forces during those years that followed, but it was a joint and combined war in the purest sense of the word, an exemplary example of air, land, and maritime forces and space supporting assets all working together to produce an outcome with the least possible loss of friendly and non-combatant enemy lives.
Which takes us to the end of our show, and I guess the question is, what are you doing now? You've written this book. It launches tomorrow. What are you going to do next, and who are you going to do it?
Well, you know, I'm wondering if the time has not come to revisit my 1990 book, The Transformation of American Air Power, because we've had 10 years now following a triumphal period of American air power from Desert Storm through Iraqi freedom, where air power really showed its final maturation. But today, fast forwarding 10 years later, it's been a very different kind of fight. It's been mostly a counterinsurgency fight with ground troops being in the forefront, to the point where some of the younger aviators out there now, lieutenants and captains who entered the force only around 03, 04, 05, have come to think that the only role of air power is to support ground troops because that's all we've been doing. That really is not the case at all. I mean, as my friend, and you probably know him as well, the British strategist Colin Gray is fond of pointing out that just because it's been cloudless and blue sky for 4 days on end doesn't mean it's time to get rid of your raincoat. I mean, we are facing an infinite amount of future out there, and there are big wars yet to come. I mean, I think if I could title the next big book I would do, it would be something like American Air Power at the Crossroads, because we now have to look at a future that we are not well prepared for, where the problem will no longer be so much counterinsurgency as new high-end threats like China, with its anti-access and area denial efforts, like Iran with nuclear weapons perhaps, like a hostile and nuclear North Korea. The day of big wars is not over, and if I were king, I would suggest that the Air Force and Navy need to begin shifting their force composition from one that was developed mainly for the Cold War with short-range fighters and something that has much longer reach and persistence to deal with vast open ocean areas that are going to be the wave of the future in decades to come. So, I mean, that's a short take on kinds of questions I would like to get into in the next few years.
And you're now you've finished up your work at RAND. You're now with another organization here in the D.C. area?
I'm affiliated as non-resident senior fellow with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. It's a good bunch of folks I've known for years and have worked with. And So even though I've nominally retired from land, I will never retire from my work because it's my hobby.
I hear you, and I want to thank you for coming on today. I hope we've given you a good chance to talk about your book and your work, and I hope you'll come back someday.
Well, it's been enlightening for me, too. This is the first opportunity I've really had to talk at length about what I wrote in the book, and I just do hope to the listeners out there that that it will be found useful as a means of educating the next generation on what modern air and space power have become.
I want to thank you for coming, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you very
much.
Great,
John. I appreciate it very much, and it was a great day. Thanks.
Bye-bye.